From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Recent corporate scandals, Enron, WorldCom, Global Crossing, and more cost Americans an estimated $200 billion. A not-so-subtle reminder of abuse and corruption in America's corporate financial system. Former SEC Chairman Arthur Levitt fought for reform and the interests of the individual investor in the bull market of the 90s. On many fronts, he failed. This hour, Arthur Levitt looks back and ahead on Wall Street's mess and your investments. We begin with the latest on Wall Street and the economy. The market has bounced back a bit in the last 2 weeks, with the Dow and NASDAQ making gains. Greg Ipp is economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. I asked him how the wavering stock market and U.S. economy are interacting.
There are two relationships. We are used to thinking of the stock market as being forward-looking and saying where the economy is going 3 months from now. And what it was saying over the summertime period as it plunged to new depths was we think that the future looks very dark. Earnings are going to be weaker than we had hoped, and there are a number of risks hanging over the economy, such as war with Iraq, higher oil prices, and the possibility that consumers whose spending has supported the economy thus far might start to stumble. Now, there's another interaction, though, between the market and the economy as well, and it runs the other direction. Stock market wealth is such a large part of people's assets, or at least it was in the heydays of the bull market, that the decline in the stock market by itself actually hurts the economic outlook because, as a result, consumers feel poorer, and when they feel poorer, they spend less. So you could almost sort of see a self-feeding process going on. Stock investors get pessimistic, stock prices go down, that makes consumers feel poorer, they spend less, and the economic outlook gets worse. And you see where this goes?
I do see where it goes. So at this point, which horse is leading which cart? We see that the market doing a little bit better in the last couple of weeks. Is that giving heart to the economy, or is it economic figures that are heartening the market?
It's very hard to say at this point, Tom. It sounds cliche to say it, but basically stock prices can't go in one direction forever. They couldn't go up forever, and it would be ridiculous to think they would also go down forever. They got to a point 2 weeks ago when the pessimism was so extreme and the bad news that people were building into their decisions was so overwhelming that it didn't really take very much good news to turn things around. All we really had was some very important companies announcing that earnings were basically as they expected, and that sort of gave people enough optimism to step back into the market. I mean, what you often have, Tom, in these sort of bear market periods is that people who had been always looking for the good news as a reason to bid up stocks had been looking for every bit of bad news possible to sell them down. And when the bad news wasn't quite as bad as people had expected, then the selling stopped. A couple other things went on. You had bonds, the yields on bonds, which are the primary alternative stocks, getting to very low levels, about 3.5%. And I think a lot of investors said to themselves, well, holy cow, surely I must be able to do better than 3.5% a year for the next 10 years in stocks. So I think some people started to say, well, forget about buying bonds, I'll buy some stocks. And that also helped turn things around.
At the same time, you quote the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, William McDonough, saying that there may be a decoupling between real people doing real things on Main Street and the financial markets around the world. What does he mean by that?
What he's saying is that when you actually look at the economy, in spite of all the bad headlines and the negatives in the markets and the things that we worry about, the economy does actually still seem to be growing. It's been a kind of a sawtooth pattern for the last year, but as best as we can tell, economic growth has been about 3%. It's usually better than that in recoveries, but that's hardly a recession. The unemployment rate has actually dropped for the last few months to 5.7%, and 5.7% is high compared to where we were in late 1999. But it's actually pretty low compared to what we have averaged over the last 30 to 40 years. So when you compare those sort of very important basic economic statistics, it doesn't seem consistent with the sort of panic we were witnessing on Wall Street.
What about the administration's role, the Bush administration, and politics? How do they play into this dance between the market and the economy? For example, the flap over the SEC and how Harvey Pitt is running things there. Clearly, it's had an impact on the stock market. Does that filter through to the economy?
Tom, I would say that during the summertime when we had the first plunge following the revelations of the WorldCom accounting fraud in late June, that the response of the politicians was very important. There was a real concern out there that accounting fraud was rampant and that we needed a strong and decisive response from policymakers to clean the matter up. And there was basically a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and an impasse between the more reform-minded people on Capitol Hill and some of the people who were more sympathetic to the position of big business in the accountants, some of whom are in the administration, and an impasse on how to resolve these problems. And I think the lack of progress on that front may have been a factor hurting people's confidence. I would have to say, though, that in the last few months, I don't think that's been so prominent an issue in people's minds. It is true that there is a dispute going on within the Securities and Exchange Commission right now about who they should pick to run this new public accounting standards oversight body, which will hopefully bring a higher degree of integrity and transparency to the accounting profession. As you may know, John Biggs, who most recently was head of TIA CREF, a very big pension plan, had been thought of as a favorite to run this organization. But there apparently was opposition from some of the Republicans on Capitol Hill and possibly from the White House as well to the view that he was too hostile to the accounting profession. And so you had Harvey Pitt, sort of, who is the chairman of the SEC, caught between these people who were opposed to him in the political arena.
Given the failings we've seen in the accounting profession in the last year, does opposition to someone who might be tough on that profession give heart to the markets and the economy then, or does it make people feel, oh no, we're just in for more of the same?
I think, Tom, at the margin, the fact that we still can't close the book on this very important issue has got to be a negative factor in people's confidence. They really do want to see the bad guys go to jail, and they want to believe that as bad as the mess has been, it's being cleaned up. And the failure to advance on this front, I think, is at the margin something that's probably hurting people's confidence.
Greg Ipp, thanks for joining us.
Sure thing, Tom.
Greg Ipp is economics reporter with The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me earlier today from Washington. It's not as though Arthur Levitt didn't warn us. In his long tenure as chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission from 1993 to 2001, Levitt hollered his fears of stock option giveaways, corrupt Wall Street analysts, and sleazy bookkeeping in the accounting industry. Nobody wanted to hear it. Now we've all paid through Enron and WorldCom and a huge loss of faith in business as usual. Call for reform rang loud through Washington and Wall Street after the wave of corporate scandal broke, but months later, much has not changed. John Biggs, a man that people say might actually reform the accounting industry, may not be appointed to a key SEC oversight board. In Washington, Democrats are calling for the removal of SEC Chairman Harvey Pitt. What happened to American business? And what are reformers up against now? Have we cleaned up yet? Do we have what it takes to clean up? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Arthur Levitt, former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission and author of Take on the Street, What Wall Street and Corporate America Don't Want You to Know, What You Can Do to Fight Back. Good evening and welcome, Arthur Levitt.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you. Arthur Levitt, there's so much we want to talk about tonight, and you've written right across the whole boardwalk in your book. It's a terrific read. But it might be helpful for our listeners to understand a little bit about you and where you came from when you stepped into the SEC chairmanship in 1993. It's not as though you'd been an anti-Wall Street zealot or even a reforming zealot, though you may correct me on that. You came right out of the heart of the brokerage business.
That's true. I started a firm which grew very rapidly, and the remains of which today is Salomon Smith Barney, part of Citigroup.
Mm-hmm.
I started as a broker. The credo in those days was, if they had it, sell it. If they don't, buy it.
In other words, make money off the investor however you can.
Make money by selling or buying and mm-hmm. being paid a commission. And mm-hmm. a chapter in my book says, how to sleep as well as your broker. Fire your broker if he's being paid commissions. The conflict is much too apparent, and I think the era of the broker being paid commissions is behind us, and we're about to enter an era of financial advisors paid by fee rather than the conflict.
We're going to talk about how that might work, but I also wanted to get across the example you saw of your own dad. You grew up in Brooklyn. Your father was New York State Comptroller.
Yes, the conversation around my kitchen table at home on the part of my mother, who was a school teacher for 38 years, and then my father, who became the sole trustee of the teacher's retirement fund, all involved retirement and which option my mother should take. She mm-hmm. cherished that retirement fund, and my father fought a fierce independent battle to protect the interests of the retirees of New York State. That obviously had an impact on me. He ran his office as a totally non-political office, keeping his predecessor's Republican appointees in place, just as I did when I came to the commission. My predecessor was Richard Breeden, and I kept all of his division directors, regardless of political party.
And your father resisted that political impact even when New York was at risk of going bankrupt and Mayor Ed Koch was coming down on him hard.
Yes, Ed Koch said to him, "Arthur, if you don't bail the city out by using the state pension funds, you will be responsible for bankrupting the city of New York." And that hurt my father grievously, even physically.
Actually left him with a stroke that very day.
Yes, that's correct, which he fortunately recovered from. But it was a very unhappy period. But the lesson I learned was when you're dealing with people's money, particularly small people, it's a sacred trust. And there are lots of forces out there that try to take advantage of them. And when I came to Washington, that had the greatest impact on the decisions that I made and the attitude that I took, much more so than my years in running a brokerage firm or running a stock exchange. I was determined to make this commission the most investor-friendly commission in history.
And we want to talk about why that was so very difficult to do, but I was struck by something you write early in the book. You say that after 28 years on Wall Street, you understood the culture, and actually there were two conflicting cultures, one that rewards professionalism, honesty, and entrepreneurship, and another driven by conflicts of interest, self-dealing, and hype. And you say this latter culture often overshadows the first, the better.
That is unfortunate. From your first days on Wall Street, you are taught such things as your word is your bond. And when you make a commitment, you must live up to it. And the integrity of the process. All true. But on the other side of the equation, what about the analysts who dissemble? What about the brokers who sell products almost entirely to generate commissions because that's the only way they're being paid? What about the offerings of IPOs and companies that make very little economic sense, but which the firm knows will be snapped up by a public that's unable to distinguish between what's good and what's awful? That's the issue that regulators had to deal with. And what about the markets that were collusive? When I came there, the NASDAQ market was totally collusive, and we brought a major case against NASDAQ for price fixing.
I have to say, as I went through the book, I just looked down the chapters that you cover there, you know, the problems with brokers, the problems with mutual funds, the problems with analysts, the problems with false profit statements, the problems with corporate governance, you begin to feel like we've got serious rot here.
I think we have a systemic problem resulting from an almost two-decade-long erosion of ethical values, not just on the part of the brokerage industry, but on the part of corporate America. I mean, look at the kinds of executives that we revered and put on the covers of magazines, the muscular executives who were, at a stroke of a pen, bought companies, another stroke, sold them, and then fired 10,000 people and smiled and said this was in the interests of profits. Well, that's an era gone and dead as far as I'm concerned, because the CEOs that will survive in this terrible environment will be very different from those tough guy, muscular CEOs.
And we're going to talk about that, but I guess in a nutshell, do you think we've taken a blow serious enough to wake the company up, to make the country up, to make the kinds of changes we need in our financial system, in Wall Street, and corporate governance? Or is it still open question?
I think humiliation and embarrassment has changed the culture in America's boardrooms. But I still think the congressional support for fundraising corporate executives and lobbyists is profoundly influential. And until that breaks up or diminishes, I think investors cannot have true trust in the system. I think this fight over the commission that is overseeing the accounting profession is disgraceful.
Well, we're going to come back and talk about it. It's a scary view, but it's from Arthur Levitt, former chairman of the SEC. We've got to hear it. Question is, does the U.S. economy sit on a corrupt foundation? Are we trapped in a kind of pirate economy? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's Wall Street mess with Arthur Levitt. He was chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission from 1993 to 2001. He's out with a new book now called Take on the Street, What Wall Street and Corporate America Don't Want You to Know, What You Can Do to Fight Back. You can join us as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I guess the question is, does the U.S. economy sit even now on a corrupt foundation? Is the American financial system capable of self-correction? And if a chairman of the SEC can't get reform, who can? Join us at 1-800-423-TALK. Arthur Levitt, give us a sense, if you'd be good enough, and you've got so many unbelievable examples in the book, but of how hard it was for you when you got to Washington to get past the kind of arm-in-arm linkage of the Wall Street and investment community and the U.S. Congress when it came to reform.
Well, I guess I saw it the first time when we recognized the fact that the NASDAQ market was collusive and charging spreads that were unconscionably high.
So is that the collusion in itself, just the spread? I want to spell this out for all listeners
here. The collusion was when every brokerage firm would charge precisely the same price for an over-the-counter security.
Which meant they could charge such a big markup, such a big spread.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought a case, an action against NASDAQ. And the pressure I received from members of Congress and my oversight committee was enormous. And one of them called me in and said, Arthur, you know, the brokers in my community really are very unhappy about this. And I said to him, look, this is an enforcement matter.
Mm-hmm.
And some people may go to jail and certainly pay huge fines. You will be embarrassed if you press this issue. And he backed off. The second issue, in some ways, was more serious, and that's when we decided to support the independent standard setter, the FASB,
mm-hmm.
that felt that investors were entitled to know the impact of stock options on the earnings of a company.
This is the Accounting Standards Board that wanted this.
And asked that those stock options be expensed on the balance sheet. I was supportive of that until a huge political backfire began. And senators and congressmen from all over the country, led by Senator Joe Lieberman, a very competent senator from Connecticut, got a sense of the Senate, which said, if the FASB goes ahead with this proposal, mm-hmm. the Congress will overrule it. I was so concerned that that would kill independent standard setting that I backed down and I told the FASB, let's come back another day and let's just account for these options in a footnote.
And you say you now see that as your biggest mistake in all your years in the SEC?
It was the biggest mistake I made in Washington, and I'm trying to make up for it now by campaigning very aggressively to see to it that corporate America responds and that this be, in effect, a litmus test for companies that either stand with investors by expensing stock options
mm-hmm.
or stand for business as usual and corporate interests first by refusing to expense them.
Take us a little bit further into how that works, because one of the wonders of your book is that you really do name names. You're very upfront with who brought pressure and how they brought it. In this instance, if I've got this right, you heard from two Silicon Valley huge VIPs, John Chambers, CEO of Cisco Systems, and John Doerr, a mega venture capitalist, saying essentially, hey, get back in line or we're gonna bring congressional pressure that will steamroller you, Arthur Levitt.
Yes, those threats came very often. Hundreds of CEOs came through my office talking about this issue, and lots of members of Congress who couldn't begin to understand an accounting standard badgered me about this and said that if I went ahead with it, they would override it by congressional action. That was only one instance where Congress has acted in defiance of investor interests, and investors didn't know about it and don't understand how significant congressional influences on investment results.
And when you say investors, you mean individual investors, the kind of smaller investors who poured into the American stock markets in the 1980s and 90s.
I'm talking about the investors who were so grievously hurt in this market meltdown. Many investors could take a loss of 30 or 40 or 50% and come back. But the investors who were depending upon their investments for college tuitions and retirement, they won't come back and they can't come back. And they are the ones that the actions of Congress hurt most. And that I find unforgivable. Politicizing the process of investing is just plain outrageous and wrong.
And I want to talk a little bit also about the implications of that for the American economy and its future. But a lot of people want to join us. I hope you'll let me invite them in as we go along here. David's calling from Spokane Valley, Washington. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? It said that the motto of America is "In God We Trust," but it really seems that the motto of America is Milton Friedman's statement, "Social responsibility of business is profit." I mean, America works on the idea that somebody's going to take my dollar and turn it into profits for themselves. They're going to sell me something, whether it's stocks or what have you. That's the basis of our society. That's why we, you know, why we exist. I don't agree with the direction that things are going in this whole unethical turn to things, but we're way down that road. And that's the way that our system works.
David, we've all been raised and educated to believe that that is exactly what works, that that produces growth, jobs, affluence, and all the rest. Are you unsold on that?
It also produces a lot of social decadence, which we're seeing. I mean, you can talk about the decadence of these corporate officials, but look at what's going on in our society that really doesn't make the nightly news to the extent that some of this other, you know, highfalutin issues, international issues, war, corporate profits, et cetera. There's a lot of suffering. There's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of things going on in our country that our profit-driven system isn't directed towards addressing, and we're not going to look at them because, again, that what we're really all about and what has to keep moving is that search for the almighty dollar and the, you know, profits. These people have only these muscular, as he called them, swashbuckling profiteering capitalists. You know, these guys are. They're just doing what the system's all about, and they've just gone too far in doing it.
Well, David, we got it. Let me put it to Arthur Levitt. I appreciate your call. Arthur Levitt, I want to come at this, I guess, take two slices at it. First, let's take the big sort of broad one that David lays out there, saying, you know what, American capitalism isn't nearly finely tuned enough to really care about what's going on in this country. Do you look at our big capitalistic system in those terms? Is that fair? Is it as Churchill said of democracy, the worst but for all other systems? How do you judge it with your experience and your frustrations?
I don't judge it the way David does. I believe the system does work. This is not uncharted territory. Mm-hmm. We've been here following Teapot Dome and the Penn Central scandals. And part of the problem here has not just been politicians who can't see beyond their most recent campaign contribution, but part of it is a public that was so seduced by a runaway bull market that they didn't bother to be the kind of skeptical buyers that a smart buyer should be. The whole process broke down and now is in the process of correcting itself. Now, part of it is working and working well, but part of it isn't, and the part that isn't is the political interference in the process.
Well, let me ask you then on a little bit more subtle plane, if we can have both high growth, the kind we got used to in the 90s, or you know, something high at least, and high ethical standards. Or we see a debate in the papers now, venture capitalists resisting certain kinds of transparency, lots of business interests, as I'm sure you've heard 1,000 times, resisting the expensing of stock options, accountants resisting reform. They're saying, if we bring all this regulation into our system, we may be all, nice and tied up in a bow, but we won't have the kind of rangy, free economy that produces high growth. Do you buy that?
No, I don't buy all parts of that. I think that we can overregulate and choke our markets, but I don't think we're near that at this point. And I do believe that the corrections have to come from within. I think that the smartest business leaders that I know understand that they have a huge perceptual problem, and the level of anger at American business has probably never been higher. But I believe that humiliation has changed behavior, to begin with, in the corporate boardrooms. I think people who serve on boards are acting differently than they did as recently as 6 months ago. But I want to reiterate that the people who have the greatest influence on all this, the members of Congress, are still acting as business as usual. And I think that's unfortunate. And that won't change without investor fury and investor anger.
John's calling from Minneapolis-St. Paul. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Arthur Levitt, I wanted to thank you very much for the work you did to make the markets more efficient, more transparent. But I do have a major criticism, and that is that I think we're criticizing business here. We're criticizing the industry, the brokerage industry. But really, it was the greed bubble, the demand for investors for five-star funds and internet stocks and IPOs, which they knew nothing about any of those investments, which fed this bubble, fed the damage, and has fed every investment collapse in the past. And I'd like you to respond to that.
John, thanks for your call. Arthur Levitt?
I agree with you. I didn't mean to leave the impression that investors were guiltless here. I think, as I said before, they bought into this and didn't exercise the usual skepticism. And what we've just witnessed has been a failure of all the traditional gatekeepers out there to intended to protect investors, lawyers, accountants, boards of directors, regulators, rating agencies, and investors themselves. Investors, I quite agree with you, bought on the basis of hype and promotion and didn't bother to use the two words that are most important to investor success, ask questions. Mm-hmm. An investor who bought Enron stock should have their head examined. They couldn't possibly understand what that company was about, and that didn't stop them.
And yet you said at the same time, Arthur Levitt, that when you yourself, with all your experience in the financial world, turn to the reports from mutual funds that you're in, you can't understand them. I mean, I finished the book wondering to myself if this kind of mass participation in the stock market can work, if you have to read book after book to have a hope of even understanding what's going on. Do we have a mismatch here? Is it possible to either regulate the market so well that investors don't have to be so canny, or to educate investors to that level where tens of millions and more can effectively participate?
Well, let me address that issue. When I came to Washington under the terms that a public official has to adhere to, I had to sell everything I owned and put it into mutual funds. And for the first time, I began to read those prospectuses and found that even after a history in the business, I found them convoluted and confusing. And that led me to a very important initiative, which continues to this day, of having the mutual funds mandating that they use a new language, plain English, and having corporate America use plain English. And that is going on today in spite of the concerted opposition of the legal profession, which wants to be the unique interpreters of an arcane language that only they understand. We've made great progress in the way mutual funds and corporations communicate and government communicates with investors, and I'm proud of what we did while I was there to implement that initiative.
John, thanks for your call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sue's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Wonderful guest and wonderful show. I just wondered what your guest, he's talking a lot about Congress's effect, and I wonder about President Bush and Dick Cheney as some of those muscular CEOs of our country and their involvement in Halliburton and such, and what he thinks about whether things will really change given that they're our leadership right now. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call, Sue. Arthur Levitt, what about this administration? You were part of the Clinton administration. How much does it matter, given the congressional roadblocks you've described and the business interests you've described?
Well, I think that an administration sets the tone at the top. And I do think that President Bush did the right thing in condemning bad business practices and supporting the Sarbanes bill that was passed by the Senate and signed by the president. But my experience with the Clinton administration was not once did they interfere with any policy of the SEC while I was there. Not once did they send me anyone to hire. Not once did they express a view about an issue that I undertook. I would hope that this administration is adhering to those standards. I don't know whether they are or not.
So you're describing that as a good thing, that they didn't interfere. But could you have used more support from the White House? I mean, in retrospect, people have said, you know, maybe we were all part of a kind of codependency here, with the White House effectively becoming a cheerleader for the bubble.
When the Congress threatened the funding of the SEC, both Republicans and Democrats, mm-hmm. when we wanted to move ahead with auditor independence, I called the White House and received a commitment from Larry Summers that the president would veto any bill that choked off funding for the SEC. When I needed them, they were there.
Mm-hmm. Kevin's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air. Hello. Kevin, are you there? I think we've lost Kevin. You're right, Arthur Levitt, that early on you saw a web of dysfunctional relationships among analysts, brokers, and corporations growing increasingly worse. Have we bottomed out on this thing now? You've said a couple of times that humiliation is kind of the tonic that will turn it around. But I have to say, in part through the vivid description in your own book, I'm a little skeptical about that. You describe how deeply vested these interests are.
We have not totally bottomed out. We still have investment banking and research under the same wing. And I think that must be changed. We still have analysts who are basically cheerleaders for the companies. We still have mutual funds sold by brokerage firms because they're paying that firm for shelf space. When you go to the firm and ask them, what's the best mutual fund for me? The firm will say, well, you can pick from our preferred list. That preferred list still calls for companies that paid the firm a fee to be on the preferred list. That the customer never knows. We still see companies underwriting companies that have no economic merit whatsoever and are bound to lose money for
bringing
investors.
Them public.
Yes.
But do you really think that all these practices that you just described are going to be cleaned up on Wall Street's own volition?
No. I think it's going to take media pressure. It's going to take public pressure. We have in front of us right now evidence of a bill, the Sarbanes bill, and its implementation in terms of the appointment of an oversight commission, and there's a huge fight on that issue. That is hardly the stuff to reassure investors.
Arthur Levitt, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about America's Wall Street mess with Arthur Levitt, former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He's out with a new book, Take on the Street, What Wall Street and Corporate America Don't Want You to Know. You can join the conversation. Can we have high growth and high ethical standards on Wall Street in American business? And can individual investors survive the systemic corruptions of Wall Street that Arthur Levitt describes? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's Wall Street mess with Arthur Levitt. He was chairman of the SEC for 7 years until 2001. He's out with a new book called Take on the Street, What Wall Street and Corporate America Don't Want You to Know. Who do you trust now when it's time for a cleanup? Do you believe Arthur Levitt when he says individual investors can fight back? And are all these ethical pitfalls just the price of a free market system? Do we have to have gouging to have growth? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Alan's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to ask, the whole problem is how to move this thing off of dead center. And,
yes.
And the problem, of course, is that we have politicians that have been bought and sold, you know, 100 times over during their career by the same people that don't want change. And, I mean, it's an old story.
Mm-hmm.
But what tends to get this out, we've had these problems before after every speculative splurge, is the beginning of a third party, which scares the members of the two mainstream parties.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, I mean, McCain has been has been in the forefront of trying to do something about this. He now doesn't have a Republican Party that's backing him.
So you're saying, will anything other than a third-party challenge work?
That's what I wanted to ask Mr. Leavitt, exactly.
Let's put it to him, Arthur Leavitt.
Yes, I think the difficulty of setting up a third party makes another option more attractive, and that is for investors to pay close attention to what their senators and congressmen are doing. It's easy to find out the bills that are up there that affect investors. I give you the websites in the book. But hold those congressmen and senators accountable for what they're not doing for you, and try to band together through existing groups, whether they be AARP or the Consumers Federation of America or the AFL-CIO or the Motley Fool. Band together and begin to make an impact on those guys and say that you simply won't accept the way they are favoring interests other than investor interests.
But right now,
you see the same politicians that were trying to choke the SEC while I was there, sounding like Elmer Gantry, latter-day reformers. Well, it's the height of hypocrisy.
You talk about Representative Billy Towson from Louisiana in that regard.
Yes. Yes.
So, saying don't believe it when he rages on camera how unhappy he is with the way business has been run.
He was one of the principal spear carriers for the accounting profession. And if you look at the letters in the back of my book signed by so many members of Congress and the Senate urging me, lay off the accountants. This is just wrong.
But do you really believe that the individual investors going to websites, sending in letters, can be a counterweight to that corporate influence? You describe its weight so vividly, it makes it look awfully hard to push back against.
It's not just one element.
Mm-hmm.
The letters and the visits and the accountability is certainly important. Media attention is critical because nothing galvanizes the interests of a politician more than what his local or national newspaper is saying. And the responsible actions of boards of directors. These factors collectively will make for a fairer climate. But maybe the most important factor of all is skepticism on the part of investors. Don't accept blindly what you see. Don't accept offerings because someone tells you this at the barbershop or at the bar.
You know, Arthur Leavitt, that's easy to say, but when the whole system gets geared up to kind of take your money, as it was clearly geared up in the 90s, and you describe how it's an interlocking system, everybody's got an interest in it on the street, it's awfully hard for an individual investor to stand up to that. When, you know, hour after hour, CNBC is saying, here's a great buy, here's a great buy, here's a great buy. The analysts are saying the same thing.
But by the same token, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times mm-hmm. are exposing bad practices.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you buy a car, you don't accept the first price that the car salesman offers you. You become a skeptical buyer.
Mm-hmm.
I think the buyers of stock historically have treated brokers as Olympian creatures who couldn't be questioned. I'm suggesting don't accept those notions. Be smart investors. Shop for best prices. Ask questions.
Take us right into this SEC brouhaha at the moment. Harvey Pitt does not want to bring John Biggs in, and there's clearly Republican pressure and maybe even Democratic pressure for him not to, maybe even White House pressure. How big an indicator is that, just to take one?
I think it's a very large indicator as to whether this SEC is as nonpartisan as it should be. If they cannot get a unanimous vote for whomever they choose, in my judgment, they failed the people. They failed the people by not coming up with a candidate that all of them can support. Biggs is unquestionably highly qualified. Pitt has said that. The other commissioners have said it. If he's the one that can get a unanimous vote, he should get it. If they substitute almost anyone else and don't get a unanimous vote, they have failed investors and failed them grievously.
Well, investors, there's one game to watch for. Mike's calling from Green Lake, Wisconsin. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Leavitt.
Hi.
We met last year in a conference in Denver for independent advisors, and your presentation was how we should look out for the best interest of those independent investors because they don't really have someone to stand up for them.
Are you a stockbroker, Mike?
No, actually, I'm a registered investment advisor.
Okay.
I started my own company 10 years ago because I did not want to work for the industry.
Does that mean you don't help your clients buy and sell stock?
Not on a commission basis, no.
Okay.
Really, it's approached from an advisory standpoint, doing financial planning, looking at the whole picture, and if they should desire to buy stocks, that's great and wonderful. But my compensation is not based upon what they purchase.
And do you see the whole industry going that way, as Arthur Levitt has said this hour he does?
Well, certainly you do see that. Being an independent advisor, there are a lot of brokerage houses that are now buying up advisory firms. And the industry, you see the commercials on TV these days where the industry says, you know, come see our broker who isn't encouraged by commission. They're going to this fee basis. But whether or not people will be forgetful of what's happened in the past is yet to be found out.
So what's your question for Arthur Levitt as he looks out on this whole ugly landscape, Mike?
Well, I would ask him, does he believe that the independent advisory industry, has that growth of that industry really had an effect on the brokerage firms now that are looking to purchase those advisors, which are and have always been on a fee basis?
Arthur Levitt.
I think it has. I think the era of the commission-based broker is behind us, and we're about to enter the era of the independent advisor. And I also think that brokers should be treated as fiduciaries in the same way that advisors are.
Treated as fiduciaries meaning?
Having a fiduciary responsibility for their investment advice.
Will the brokerage industry work if it's flipped over to that kind of premise?
I think so.
That's a different world. Can you have the same people? Can this year, this week, I'm a commission-based broker, and next year, next week, I understand how to work as someone with a fiduciary responsibility?
I think that brokers can be trained and firms can gear themselves in a direction that they have to in order to restore public confidence in the system.
Mike, thanks for your call. Tam is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Tam. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is really two parts. The first is, isn't the Wall Street scandal proof that we learned nothing from the banking scandal, and aren't they related?
You mean of the 80s?
That's right.
The SNLs.
And the second part is, haven't we created captive investors by transferring the retirement and pension responsibilities from corporations to the 401k plan?
Ooh, that's a great question. Let's put them. Thanks for your call, Tim. Arthur Levitt, how about it?
It is a great question, and clearly transferring pensions to the 401ks, relieving corporations of a fixed obligation, has created some aberrations. And I think that it's unfortunate that we're unable to supply investors who simply don't have the level of knowledge of investments with the information that they need to make informed judgments. The Labor Department, which is responsible for advising investors, simply is understaffed and is not able to do the job that they were intended to do.
But Tama describes those people in the 401ks who are no longer in company retirement plans as kind of captive investors. They don't, in her view, perhaps have much choice but to be in the market, whether they understand it or not.
That's true. They really don't have an alternative, and their pensions are at risk. And we've seen that happen. And I think changes have to be made, some of which have been suggested by Congress. What was the first part of the question?
We'll come to it. I've got it right here. I just want to say first, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The first part of Tama's question was about this crisis being a continuation of the banking crisis of the 80s, the SNL crisis.
I don't think so. The SNL crisis was caused by other factors. This crisis, in my judgment, was caused by the excesses built into a runaway bull market where values went way out of proportion, where investors suspended belief, where everyone felt that we were on the verge of what Silicon Valley called a new paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't believe it, and I don't believe in new paradigms. The verities of a bottom line are still what controls markets, and what we've seen in this recent downturn has been a return to values that are more realistic than they ever were during the height of the bull market.
Tama's phrase, captive investors, is still ringing in my ears, and I'm wondering...
It's a good way of putting it.
It is, and people are kicked out of company pension plans. Now they're in the 401k. They essentially have to get a market-scale return. Does that turn millions of Americans into, you know, chickens just there for the plucking? Not everyone who's dumped into a 401k is going to be able to read those mutual fund reports that even you have trouble with.
No, I think that's true, and I think I have suggested some things in the chapter on 401ks. But one byproduct of this, I think, is it has, in my mind, killed any chance of privatization of Social Security for the next several years.
Andre's calling. Andre's calling, I should say, from Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, Andre. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Mr. Leavitt.
Hi.
Hi. Hey, first, I just wanted to thank you for how you're using your influence.
Hear, hear.
Excuse me?
Hear, hear, I say. It's great.
Yeah, and being outspoken.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to point out that the market is... Well, first I wanted to attempt to answer your question directly in sort of a direct way, which is that obviously I think in order to have high growth, you need to have high ethical standards. I guess that's sort of an obvious answer to the question, can you have high growth?
Well, but somehow in the 90s it wasn't so obvious, was it? Because we had super high growth and we did not have high ethical standards.
Well, that might be a little bit misleading because there are other factors involved, of course. But but in the sense that the market, and I'm sure Mr. Leavitt knows this, is the pricing of the market is intimately related to risk. And risk is also very directly related to trust. Then to the extent that unethical behavior creates a lack of trust. In a sense, these people are making, say, $1 million by costing the rest of us a large amount of money. They're really crooks that are sort of parasites on the economy, which is really the opposite of the way it should be. If you make $100 million for the economy, and you keep a couple, you know, you get to keep a couple million for yourself.
Andre, our clock is running down. Let me put that over to Arthur Leavitt. Arthur Leavitt, there it is again, this issue of ethics, high ethics and high growth. In the 90s, we saw high growth without the latter. Are we on a track back toward high ethics? How confident are you of that? And if we get there, can we have the kind of economy Americans want?
Let me say first that the intelligence of that question is something that reinforces my confidence in the wisdom of the investing public. I think that where market forces work, again, is the punishing that corporate America is now taking at the hands of individuals who must supply that capital for the system to flourish. The media itself has been a useful discipline, and hopefully the SEC and other regulators will take their responsibility and recognize the primacy of the investor over all other influences. If that works, we've got a growth economy that we can be proud of. I'm optimistic.
I'm glad you are.
It's not going to happen by itself.
And your book makes that plain. Arthur Leavitt, thank you so much for your efforts in Washington and now and for your book. And thanks for being with us tonight. Arthur Leavitt is author of Take on the Street, What Wall Street and Corporate America Don't Want You to Know, What You Can Do to Fight Back. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.